Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com, or you can type a few more characters and go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about the future. We talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about what we think is going to be a very bright future, one that we'll all very much want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always, is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. How are you, Stephen?
Hey, Phil. I'm doing great, man. You doing all right?
Well, as I was mentioning before we started the show, I've actually been tracking the progress of a cold that I caught last week on my Facebook page. And I think I'm just about back to super fantastic right now.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, let me clarify. You're tracking the progress of the cold on Facebook, or you caught the cold on Facebook? I'm just kind of trying to figure out how that would have happened.
I think one could theoretically catch a virus of some kind on Facebook, but I don't see how an actual human being could catch a cold. No. You know how you put your status? It says Phil is, and then blah, blah, blah. You know, I put thinking he's getting a cold, and they're like seriously in the throes of a cold and maybe coming out of the cold. So, you know, people who've been checking my Facebook page regularly, which I assume, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people
that's right
do, have been following the progress of the cold, and I'm delighted to report to them all, I'm sure to their great relief, that I'm feeling much better now.
And this one's not the one that's going to take you down. That's good.
This is not the one. Absolutely not. How about you? What's new with you?
Well, I spent the last few days camping out with my kids, and it was one of those experiences. It's a perfect situation for camping, because what you do is you get a cabin so that the wife and maybe the younger kids can sleep there, and then you go down and tent camp, you know, down by the river. That's where I was, with the older kids, and everybody was happy that way, you know.
That's a nice compromise, because I guess if the weather gets really severe, then everybody could move into the cabin, right?
Well, and we considered that, because, I mean, we weathered a pretty bad storm out there, but, you know, the tent didn't blow down on us, and so we didn't have to go in. So we felt, you know, like Grizzly Adams after the night. We were able to tough it out, so that's fine.
Well, it's not, you know, roughing it maybe is a little bit easier when you know you're kind of working with a net. Right.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. There's always the option of abandoning that and going up to the house, but
exactly. Yeah. So we've also got Michael Darling on the line. Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Good evening.
Hey, Michael. You're going to be monitoring the chat room for us this evening. But before you get started on that, I wanted to get a quick M report from you on, I believe you attended some kind of robotics competition this weekend. Could you tell us what
this,
that was all about?
Yeah. In a nutshell, there's an organization called FIRST. I'm sure that was an acronym for something, or it was symbolic of something, but I don't know anything about it. I got a short notice Friday afternoon from somebody who said, hey, you should go see this thing. It's at the local university. It's actually Friday and Saturday. I made it down there on Saturday. FIRST is an organization founded by Dean Kamen that is dedicated to creating events and putting out, how should we say, challenges, although it's not really like an X challenge, in order to get high school kids and younger kids interested in engineering and science. And in this case, it was the FIRST robotics competition, not FIRST like it's the first one they've had, but FIRST because that's their name. And the deal with that is every year about January, they put out the basic parameters of the robotic challenge and a kit, and from that kit and from that challenge you build your robot to meet the challenge, and then you have competitions with other teams from other places. The competition here this weekend in Denver was the regional competition. There were teams as far away as Southern Cal and Kansas and who knows where. And all I can say is I felt like a foreign national at my first baseball game, where it was kind of cool to watch what was going on and stuff happened, but I have no idea how teams scored and why certain teams started cheering crazy when their robot did something or when somebody else's robot didn't do something. But it was wicked cool.
So were the robots interacting with each other? They weren't, like, playing soccer or any of that kind of thing? Or
okay, the basic field, and they even referred to it as a field. There was an MC. He was doing his best to keep the energy up, and my wife leaned over to me at one point with the music blaring and said, yeah, the music kind of gives away the parent age group here, the generation. I'm like, I disagree. It gives away the age group of the special effects and the event company that set the thing up. But it was all rock and roll from the late 80s, early 90s, and a very high energy group of high school kids that were doing this thing. But the field looked like a cross between a very small soccer field, and when I say small, maybe 30 feet the long way, and maybe 15 or 20 feet the stubby, the short way, and a small racetrack. And across the center of that was like a large scaffold, and on top of the scaffold were four large balls, two red, two blue, and when I say big, they're like the giant yoga balls or whatever. They're bigger than any game sport ball you would use, you know, maybe 3 feet across, sitting up on this scaffold. And at the beginning of each round,
robots
ranged from one that was looked like a Roomba. In fact, it looked a lot like a Roomba with a little Maserati model glued to the top of it, to one that was like almost as tall as this scaffold that was probably 8 feet high.
Wow.
And the deal was, at the beginning of each round, there were three teams on each end of the field, and those three teams for that particular round formed either the red team or the blue team. So you had six robots competing in one two-team session, and the start would be what they were calling hybrid mode. It was clear that in hybrid mode, they turned the power on, and then for the first 30 seconds, the robots did whatever they did for 30 seconds. There was no controlling of them. There was no, it's just whatever they were built to do for the first 30 seconds, that's what they did, and they could get points. After that, kids would step up or team members would step up to the control panel and now be driving their robots. So the question was, were they interacting? Well, if you count crashing into each other and stealing the ball from each other and getting in each other's way, yes. If you count,
that sounds like interaction to me, yeah.
Yeah, there was no, like, collaboration in the sense that, you know, it was like a play designed where the two teams would go and do the X and the other one would go. No, and that it was clear you got points for knocking the ball off of the scaffold for your color. You got points for putting it back up on the scaffold. You got points for throwing it over the scaffold. If you made a lap of the track, there were little lines on the track where you could tell how far the robot dragged the ball around. And you got points for the ball just going around the track. You also got points for your bot just going around the track. And one team, this little one that looked like a Roomba, was roughly that size, it was clear that they blew off all point possibility from knocking the ball off the scaffold or putting it back up there. Their little thing was fast, stayed out of everybody's way, and just made lap after lap after lap after lap.
It's got this kind of Quidditch feel to it, doesn't it? I mean, you know, there's two different ways to score going on at the same time.
There was at least five different ways to score.
Oh, okay.
There was at least two ways to get penalties. I didn't figure out the penalties. There was bonus point.
Who won?
I wasn't there at the end. Although I'll say this, I wouldn't have been able to tell who won anyway, because I would have had to go and ask one of the individual competing teams, "Hey, do you get to go to nationals now?" Because this was a regional competition. The national competition's coming up third weekend in April in Atlanta, and teams from all over the country will converge there to compete on the same challenge. Whatever the rules are for this Quidditch match, it's the same.
They're doing the same thing in Atlanta. Well,
with really the same bot. I mean, you could fix it, you could work on it. There's things you could do, but there is no way you're going to redesign your bot in the next 2 weeks and have a whole different approach to the
challenge. They're pretty much committed to the robot they've got. Well, good luck to the winners, whoever they were. And of course, we're big.
These were autonomous robots, right? No remote control was going on, right?
No, there was a lot of remote control going on. Although, it appeared that at least in one case, it looked like there was that the bot actually had the ability to sense the ball, because if the ball came what appeared to be its field of view, its big arms would come out and try and grab the ball. But when the ball wasn't in its field of view, it just kind of stood there very zen-like and calm. I was like, that thing is sensing the ball, but I couldn't tell, and I didn't want to go down and interrupt the teams. Like I said, I was a foreign national at my first sporting event where I didn't know the rules, but it was very cool.
It sounds very cool. It sounds like a lot of fun. Well, FIRST is a great organization. We had Tyler Emerson on the program back later part of last year, talking a little bit about FIRST, and I think PJ Manny has mentioned them in the past too.
Yep.
That's great that they're
And one footnote, they have not only the robot challenge, they have other events and they have a for various age groups, one of which is the FIRST Lego League. It seems like a logical tie-in there for the younger kids to build something with Legos that can do stuff. And, of course, as we were leaving from the venue, it's the hockey arena for the university, as we're walking out of the stadium and the rock music is blaring and it's going crazy, my 8-year-old gets recruited by one of the FIRST reps there saying, hey, do you have a team at your school, and would you like one? And, hey, there's your dad. He could be the so I'm quite confident we're going to build our own team here at our own school.
That is outstanding.
Well, keep us posted on that as that comes together. That sounds like that sounds like a really cool development.
Harvey in the chat room asked if you could get nachos at that event.
And I'm just answering, yes, they had full concessions.
Okay. Well, then that makes it an official sporting event then.
It was as close to the cross between a sporting event and a rock concert atmosphere as you could get, knowing that at the end it was going to be these machines chasing these balls around the track. I mean, it was good. And if you go to the FIRST site, the website, they have some videos up there of prior events from prior years, and I like the fact that they sort of keep the solutions from around the country. They don't put them up on the website in this year because teams in other parts of the country haven't seen it yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
But or haven't seen that solution. And when they'll get to Nationals and they'll see the team with the giant arms from Colorado or whatever, I like that. But when you look at it, it doesn't do it justice. It doesn't begin to capture either the atmosphere or the sense of being there when these kids who have worked on this machine and now are up there and they're going to compete through their machine. It was very cool.
Sounds great. It's great to, you know, one, to have a competition. Any competition like that, of course, is going to be a lot of fun. But one that has got young people, you know, applying their minds, right, working on technology, working on making something new happen in the world. That's just that's a terrific combo. So yeah, get that team going, Michael, and keep us posted on that.
Will do.
All right. Well, we're going to send you off into the chat room now, so you can. You can answer questions about nachos and let us know when things get all hot and heavy in there, will you?
Will do.
All right. Well, with that, I am going to quickly shift gears, and we're going to bring out our guest this evening. We're very pleased to welcome Wayne Radinsky to Fast Forward Radio. Wayne started his career as a futurist in 1997 when he was working as a software developer. And he asked the question, why does Moore's Law happen? And has spent the last few years figuring out maybe some answers to that, as we'll get into a little bit later. He was part of the Bay Area Future Salon in Silicon Valley for 5 years before moving to Colorado and starting the Boulder Future Salon. And he's also a director of the Global Futures Network, which we've invited members of the Global Futures Network to listen this evening and perhaps participate in the chat and call in. We will be taking your calls a little bit later this evening, and for those who'd like to join us, you can join us at 1-347-215-8972. Wayne, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you, Phil.
So let's start with some basic questions. Can you tell us, what is a future salon? How did you get involved in the one in Silicon Valley? And what made you decide you wanted to get one going in Colorado once you moved to Boulder?
Okay, fair enough. A future salon is really just a group of people that meet to discuss the future. And it was started in 2001 by a man named John Smart. He started the first one in L.A., and he started the second one in Silicon Valley which has been run by Mark Finnern since 2001. Mark Finnern is a guy who works at SAP. He's actually from Germany, and he's quite an interesting guy. And that was the one that I got involved with. So we started off as just a little group of eight people that met in a bookstore in San Mateo, and we would discuss various topics related to the future. And that group grew to be quite large. It grew to 30 or 40 people on a regular basis, and they had certain topics where the number of people would get even larger, and had a lot of very interesting speakers come in to talk about various things. So when I got to Colorado, I decided that I would like to do something similar. So I started a Future Salon in Boulder. How's that?
And how would you distinguish, or would you distinguish, between the one that you have in Boulder and the ones in California? Is it pretty much the same, or is there a separate kind of Colorado feeling? Does each one have its own character based on where it is geographically, or is kind of interest in the future more of an overriding characteristic?
I would say that interest in the future is pretty universal, but each future salon definitely has its own unique character. The one in Silicon Valley, as you might imagine, had a very strong technological focus. So there's a lot of talk about software, hardware, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, those types of things. And we've talked about those topics at the Boulder Future Salon, too, but we've also had a lot of topics that come from, I would say, more of an environmental perspective. We've talked about issues like global warming and peak oil and overpopulation and stuff like that. And we've had a lot of topics that relate to economics. And we've also had a lot of topics that are just kind of social in nature, which is actually true of the Boulder Future Salon, too, because Mark Finnern was interested in social topics a lot as well. So we've talked about things like the future of religion and the future of conflict resolution. We had a future of persuasion discussion that you were actually at. I don't know if you remember.
I do remember that. It started as the future of marketing and then turned into the future,
yeah, exactly.
Future of persuasion. One of the things that I would say about the kind of personality of the Boulder Future Salon, and it's the only one I've been to, so I can't compare it to others, but just my observation about it is that it's a very, and I mean this in the best possible sense, Boulder group of people, because I'm not from Boulder. I work in Boulder, but I don't live in Boulder, and I always feel like I'm sort of the special guest from the outside world at the Boulder Future Salon. We talked about the future of persuasion, which was originally the future of marketing, and it amuses me to no end how often marketing is brought up as kind of this sort of, if not evil, at least highly suspicious force in the world. And of course, I have to keep reminding the group, well, actually, I work in marketing, so you know, it's okay to talk, but just keep in mind that you've got one of them amongst you right now. Now, with that in mind, would you say that a future salon is more for sharing of information, or is it more for advocacy of particular positions?
It's more for sharing of information.
Okay.
The future salon doesn't advocate any particular perspective or point of view, or it's trying to push the future into any particular direction. And by the way, I noticed on Fast Forward Radio, you say a positive take on the future. At the Future Salon, well, you've only been to one, so you probably haven't noticed. But
I've been to three actually.
At the
three meetings of this one. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. Okay.
Oh, right.
Okay.
We don't have a positive take on the future. We don't have a negative take either, necessarily. Basically, we're sort of open to all topics and willing to talk about anything. So it's very open-ended in that regard.
So a dystopian would be quite at home. at the Boulder Future Salon, whereas and someone who has a more positive take on the future would be as well, I guess.
Well, personally, I tend to be suspicious of both the extremely dystopian and the extremely utopian points of view, but we definitely do discuss all of them. So, it all comes out.
Yeah, the point being that all those different viewpoints are show up, and that the salon does not advocate any of those in particular.
No, we
and
don't.
Not only does it not advocate a particular view of the outcome of the future, how happy or good that's going to be. It also doesn't take a stand on the specifics of what's going to happen or what should happen. And so I guess in that way we would distinguish a future salon and really the Global Futures Network, which is kind of an extended salon, and they both bear that relationship of kind of growing out of John Smart's Accelerating Studies Foundation.
John Smart is the guy that started the whole Future Salon phenomena,
right
down in L.A.
And is one of the founders of the Global Futures Network as well. So they have that in common.
And the Accelerating Studies Foundation, which is the sort of parent organization to all of them.
Exactly.
At accelerating.org.
Absolutely. We'll provide a link to that. In fact, I think we've got a link right now up to the wiki page for Global Futures Network, which should link back to ASF, but we'll be sure and provide a link to that. One of the things we're hoping to do eventually on Fast Forward Radio is to get John on. I feel that we're kind of chasing John Smart down on Fast Forward Radio the way Letterman did Oprah for a number of years until he finally got her on. I don't know if it'll take as long, but we're going to keep trying. Anyway, I got distracted there, but my question was going to be, so we would distinguish a future salon from some of these other groups that we've had on Fast Forward Radio, such as the World Transhumanist Association, or Foresight Nanotech, or the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, or Lifeboat Foundation. Those groups all have a particular view of the future set of outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
A future salon is where you go.
Fair characterization.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So why would, for those listening, what's the benefit of being in a future salon? Why would you recommend it? And why did you feel so strongly about being in one that you got one going yourself?
Well, I would say that every person that comes to the future salon would have a different answer to that question. I know that for myself, my major reason for getting into the whole futurist thing was coming from my background as a software developer. I basically wanted to know what the next killer app is, mainly so I could write it myself and, you know, make a lot of money and that kind of thing. But
Kurzweil got his start in futurism the same way.
Absolutely, exactly the same reason, because he says he's an inventor, and if you're inventing things, then you want to know when is the right timing. When should you start working on a particular idea, and when should you start to sell it in the marketplace?
Yeah, you don't want to invent for right now. You want to invent for when the product rolls out in a year and a half.
Exactly.
Or 2 years, or whenever.
Or however long it takes to make it.
Yeah.
Exactly, yes. And I must say, Kurzweil has had more success with this than I have. I'm not doing too good in the killer app department, but that's how I got into the whole futurist thing, and I definitely wanted to explore ideas that could lead to the next breakthroughs and the next killer app and where the technology world is going next. But I can definitely tell you that most people who are part of the Future Salon would not give that as their answer. Everybody would have a different answer. For some people, it stems from concern over the future, over things like, potential bad things that could happen, potential downsides to nanotechnology or all of these environmental issues like peak oil and global warming and population issues. So people who are looking at that, they're looking at it from the standpoint of being concerned about about negative things that could happen. And some people, I think, just like to try to predict the future as a philosophical exercise. So there's all kinds of different reasons why people get involved in the future salon.
Now, going back to your reason, from the point of view in the Kurzweilian effort to get a handle on the get a handle on your career, get a handle on what's coming next in the in IT development. Does that mean that you would say that you think that the future is to some extent predictable or knowable?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I found kind of frustrating is that the future seems, at least when it comes to technology, it seems very predictable in its sort of general, broad, overall picture, and very hard to predict in the little details. And the little details are what you need to figure out to make a lot of money. So if you want to be the next Google, for example, you need to get the little details right. And that's very hard. But predicting, if you look at a product like Google, you know, people predicted things like hypertext all the way back in the 1960s, and people could say, well, you know, we will have, you know, ways of finding information. You know, nobody used the term search engine back then, but people were describing what we today would call a search engine and the ability to search through millions or billions of documents. But nobody knew that it would be called Google and that it would work by crawling this thing called the World Wide Web, and so on. Right, so you see what I'm getting at here? Like, the broad patterns are predictable, but the details are very hard to get.
One of the things John Smart talks about is the distinction between developmental and evolutionary change. Is that the kind of distinction you're talking about? Or
I find his terminology a little confusing, but that is the right idea.
Okay.
Because he's basically getting at the idea that an evolutionary process will go in a particular direction, which is predictable, but there's also a lot of randomness, which is not predictable.
Right, and the randomness is the details, that it turns out that it's something we call a search engine, that it's something that we call Google.
Right.
But the developmental stage was what they were describing when they talked about hypertext.
eBay, Amazon, the details of those systems and why they work and make a lot of money, that would have been hard to predict.
That's definitely hard to predict. You can look at, you know, dozens of other companies that were doing something similar that didn't make it because they didn't have this or that detail right.
Exactly.
But the idea rose, right? The basic idea of what they were talking about made its way to the top. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're going to open up the phone lines now. We're talking with Wayne Radinsky of the Boulder Futures Salon. If you have a question for Wayne or would like to talk about any of the topics we've been talking about this evening, you can call us now at 1-347-215-8972.
Phil, this is Michael watching the chat room. Harvey asked a good question, and I'm going to ask it two ways. Wayne, does the Boulder Salon, in trying to discuss the future, try to figure likely futures, or is that something that GFN in general is the probability of, hey, this is really likely, that's worth discussing, versus this is hardly likely at all, that's not what we're going to discuss? Is that something that's going on?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the person is getting at, but whenever you're talking about the future, you're always talking about probabilities. It's never possible to predict things with absolute certainty. So it's not like we have a crystal ball, you know, or an oracle, and we can tell you exactly what's going to happen. You know, we can predict the phases of the moon, but when it comes to more substantive issues, we're always kind of trying to guess what's likely to happen, what isn't likely to happen.
I can say that's
always a part of
Salon,
our conversations.
At Boulder Future Salon, we often close with Wayne doing a roundtable. Once around, everyone getting a final word, so everyone gets to say what they think the future of that particular area will be, which is fun, and everyone gets to throw something in, no matter how outrageous or wacky others might view that. And I'm speaking from my own personal experience of throwing out outrageous and wacky ideas, because I think that's loads of fun. Michael, did you say there was another question, or you had two ways of phrasing it?
Well, just one was that, is that something that, that the GFN in general, whatever salon, is that part of the sort of the mindset, or is that even something that Boulder's doing?
Oh, so the question is, do future salons generally make an issue over whether what they're talking about is a likely future?
Right.
And I think, Wayne, what you said about probabilities would apply across the board.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, you have certain people that come in with a certain point of view, and they feel very certain that this will happen or that will happen, or they'll feel certain that something won't happen. But I would say the future salon format in general is always looking at the probabilities of things and looking at multiple possible scenarios.
I think y'all touched on something just a second ago. As you had asked earlier, Phil, you know, why do future salons? Fun was mentioned just now. I think I think that would be a big part of it. I mean, this getting together and talking futures. You know, if it's anything like participating on the Speculist or Fast Forward Radio, fun's a big part of it.
I think so. the opportunity to talk about these kinds of things is not something that many of us get in our everyday lives.
The day job doesn't really encourage wild speculative predictions, does it?
Depending on what your day job is,
very
I don't know.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Wayne, I don't know. Do you get many opportunities outside of the future salon to talk about these things? That's personally why I blog and why I do the podcast, because I love.
In my day job, we're always focused on what we're doing right now and what we're doing this week, and it's always, you know. It's always looking short term and not long term. The fun thing about the future salon is that you can sit back and you can take a really long term view of what's going on.
And I think the other thing that makes it fun is that you get such a just mix of perspectives on it. Speaking as somebody who takes a very optimistic view of the future, I find it great fun to come up against the polar opposite view, and those who see the risks and see the dangers and see those as almost certain to win out, you know, that makes for some really exciting conversation, I think, because you get to test your ideas and you get to test your own ability to make your case.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. And I also think it's a lot of fun meeting people that come from really different walks of life, you know, because, you know, at the day job, most people are, you know, related to software development in one way or another. And at the Future Salon, I can meet people like, you know, we have a guy who's going to come in, I don't know exactly when he's going to talk, but we have a guy, Lauren Cobb, who's going to talk about political simulations that he does. So as part of the National Defense University, he does these political simulations of different groups in especially Latin America. He focuses primarily on Latin America. And that is just so, such a different, you know, part of life from where I usually work. Last December, we had David Grinspoon come in, and he's a planetary astronomer. He came and talked about the Fermi paradox. So that was, another thing that was completely different, where we can look at things in a very cosmological sort of, you know, philosophical point of view.
Wayne, for the benefit of our listeners, real quickly, what is the Fermi paradox?
The Fermi paradox, to put it as probably quickly as possible, is the question, why aren't aliens here? If life is something that arises spontaneously anywhere in the universe, then at some point, if any spacefaring civilization came into existence anywhere in the galaxy, they would colonize the whole galaxy in, I guess it's a few tens or hundreds of millions of years, but it's a pretty short time on a cosmological time scale. So you would expect those people to be here now.
If there was a sizable number of technological civilizations.
You were mentioning the von Neumann probe earlier in the
Before the program started, we were talking about those a little bit, the self-replicating von Neumann robotic probes out exploring the universe. How do those relate to the Fermi paradox?
Well, see, if our civilization develops artificial intelligence and we develop robotics that can go up into space and self-replicate, then it would take only a short period of time in a cosmological timescale for those self-replicating robots to colonize the whole galaxy. So, but then you run into the Fermi paradox, which is, if that's possible, why aren't self-replicating robots from somewhere else already here on Earth? They're not here.
And the fact that they aren't here would tend to indicate that we might be alone in this galaxy.
They might be, and that's the whole question. That's what the Fermi paradox is all about.
So you know,
there isn't really an answer to it. It's just a philosophical exercise.
Yeah.
So, and we had him, David Grinspoon's his name. He wrote a book called Lonely Planet, which is a pretty good book. I've been reading it, and he explores all of these issues in a lot of depth. And in addition, he tells you a lot about our solar system, so it's pretty interesting. He came and talked in November.
Lonely Planet by?
Lonely Planet.
And the author was?
David Grinspoon, Grinspoon.
I read another good book, and the author escapes me, but the other one was Rare Earth. Same subject.
Also on the topic of the Fermi paradox?
That's right, and why we very well may be alone, at least in this galaxy.
I actually thought Rare Earth was more about the anthropic principle, but I haven't read it, so I probably...
Related concepts, aren't they? But yeah, you may be right.
Yeah, they're kind of related.
Now, when you get into Fermi paradox, I think you end up with broadly... I mean, there are infinite little variations on the possibilities, but the two big possibilities are they're there or they aren't, right? That we're alone, or we're not alone. I think you can take we're not alone and break that one down into we're the first ones, or we don't know how to look for them. All of our assumptions about how to look for them are wrong, something like that. Or all of that falls under the general heading of they are there. And then the other one is that very stark possibility that there's no one there. And they're both profound philosophical positions. Either one that you end up with. Was there a mood one way or another amongst the Boulder futurist, or did you get a feel from David Grinspoon as to which way he leans on the big question?
From the group, I don't think there was any sort of consensus. The questions were all over the place,
mm-hmm.
and that was really good. That was a lot of fun. For David Grinspoon, I can definitely tell you that he thinks that they're out there, but of course he has no proof.
Right.
So he's well aware that, in terms of actual evidence, we have known.
But owing to that position, then he is spending some of his effort, at least in trying to answer the Fermi paradox. Is that right? He's providing.
Well, he's supportive of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Okay.
So he'd certainly encourage everyone to run the SETI at home software and that sort of thing to help in the search.
All right. Now, we're talking with Wayne Radinsky about future salons and the future. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 1-347-215-8972. And this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the most recent salon, the one I just missed on Friday, in large part because of that cold I was mentioning earlier. Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed was, I believe, the topic.
Which, and coincidentally, was what Phil was doing.
Yeah, I was, myself personally collapsed at the time. was unable to attend. And I would note that in February, the topic was the future of education.
right.
And in January, it was the future of globalization. So that just mm-hmm. just reading off that list, Wayne, goes to the point that that you were making, that the Boulder Future Salon is very interested in social issues around the future. That those mm-hmm. kinds of topics come up.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
definitely do.
Tell us about the discussion of how societies choose to fail or succeed, and the likelihood of whether the U.S. is on the road to collapse.
This is one of our topics that is not a positive take on the future. But there were a lot of perspectives that were skeptical that this sort of thing would come about. So it's not necessarily negative either. Basically, what I did is I presented the ideas from Dmitry Orlov, who's a guy from the Soviet Union who saw the Soviet Union collapse, and he basically draws a lot of analogies between the Soviet Union just before it collapsed in our society today. And so I presented his ideas, and then I basically gave my sort of interpretation or perspective on it, and then everyone else gave their commentary on my commentary and so on. So basically he's saying that the Soviet Union had a lot of inertia in its political and economic system that continued beyond the point where it was functioning. And the U.S., even though the U.S. doesn't use a communist, centrally managed economy, that the U.S. economy is also running on inertia. And there are a lot of signs that it's not working, such as, the trade deficit and the large amounts of money that are spent on unwinnable wars and so on and so on. So I don't have time to go through all of his ideas.
Now, I would think that the big objection you would get right off the bat, and I'm sure this is mm-hmm. dealt with in the book, and I'm sure you spent some time on it on Friday, but the big objection between drawing a comparison between the Soviet Union and the U.S. would be the economic difference, to say, well,
mm-hmm.
that was a clearly non-viable economic system, whereas mm-hmm. ours has hung in there pretty well for, 225-plus years. And it seems to actually work, whereas theirs never did. So they were doomed to fail, and mm-hmm. we aren't. without knowing the specifics of his case, that would be the first thing that would come to my head. Now, was that
that's definitely the first thing that would come to anyone's head, I think. But actually, there were a lot of other differences that were brought up in the discussion, such as, for example, the Russian economy is largely driven by oil, whereas the U.S. economy is very widely diversified and is not dependent on a single commodity like that.
Right.
So, and just a lot of difference in the societies, like in Russia, there's a, one guy commented that there's sort of a collective PTSD that's hanging over the society from the, 40 million people that died under Stalin and
right.
the other Soviet leaders. And they have a lot of drinking problems and a lot of other problems that kind of fall into that. They also never had a strong tradition of rule of law. So there's a lot of differences between their society and our society. Dmitry Orlov actually points out a lot of the differences just in, for example, the geographically, like we have all these suburbs that you can only get to by cars, whereas Russia had these compact cities that were accessible by public transportation. And people tended to live with their extended families, whereas here people's extended families tend to be scattered all over. So there's differences like that as well.
Ralph Peters wrote an article that I thought was brilliant back in the late 90s on why countries fail. And he said basically that national success is eccentric. There's a bunch of different ways that a country can be successful. You know, they can put their efforts in this direction or in that direction and be success in an entirely different way than the country next door is a success. But that national failure is predictable, and he outlined, you know, seven things that, you know, if you've got these problems, you're headed towards failure. And free flow, restrictions on the information, the free flow of information, subjugation of women, inability to accept responsibility for your for collective failure or individual failure, and on and on. He gave reasons why, and just a brilliant article, I thought.
What was his name again?
Ralph Peters. And the name of the article is Spotting the Losers. I'll have a link to it.
Great title.
Yeah.
All right.
That's
I'll
interesting
that
when
out.
You mentioned the eccentricity of what causes nations to fail. I mean, I've heard theories thrown about that what really brought Rome down was the fact that they drank from lead vessels, right? That they put their water and their wine in lead and they caused sufficient genetic difficulty that they just they couldn't keep going. So there are an awful lot of factors involved in something like that.
Actually, we had a guy at the meeting who read a book called Are We Rome, which is just about this issue of how similar we are to what happened in the Roman Empire. And they did do things like debasing their currency that are kind of similar to what's going on now with, like, inflation and those kind of things. But back then, they actually had metal currency, like coins, and they would actually debase the metals in the coins. So, you know, they were literally debasing the currency.
That's where the word comes from, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Exactly.
And I would just point out, are we Rome? Well, I don't know. We're buying all this stuff from China that has lead in it. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, if you're interested in that question, get the book, Are We Rome? And because there certainly are some parallels, but there's a lot of differences, too. So it's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, that's one of the great parallels that people have always liked to draw is between the Roman Empire and the U.S. And you can definitely see the parallels and the differences between the two. But certainly if we're heading towards that kind of fate, we want to look for the warning signs of that.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're speaking with Wayne Radinsky of the Boulder Future Salon. We'll be talking with Wayne for a few more minutes, and if you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for Wayne, you can call us at 1-347-215-8972. So let's talk about these other topics.
Okay.
The future of globalization. I don't know if you saw it just this week. Peter Thiel had a really interesting piece out on globalization. Now I can't remember where it was, but I'll find the link and we'll have it up on the show notes. One of the founders of eBay was talking about where the likely investment scenarios are. Okay, if you're looking at the world from the standpoint of I want to know where to put my money. And his take was that there are basically no good bets that don't involve globalization working out. That if we don't ultimately sort of become a single world economy that kind of works, that has us more involved with each other than we have traditionally been in the past, then the direction is not just for like national failure for the U.S., but ultimately for almost a kind of a global failure. Now, how would that fit into what the Salon was discussing, where globalization is concerned? Would that have been one of the perspectives, or would that be pretty far?
I would say that most people, or at least the most vocal people, definitely thought that globalization would work out, and that it would result in a better standing of living for most people in the world. Yeah.
Any, how about interesting dissenters on that? Anyone thinking that we're heading for hell in a handbasket because of all this globalization? Or?
Well,
see, I would expect
of
that
course,
out of the Boulder group. I'm kind of disappointed that wasn't a...
Of course, we had our guy who thinks that peak oil and global warming are going to put a real damper on globalization.
Oh, okay.
And the argument there is that peak oil, if you raise the price of oil enough, it makes shipping expensive, which makes, you know, hauling all these container ships from China with all these manufactured goods from China a lot more expensive, so it becomes cheaper to make things locally and cheaper to grow food locally. Right now we have a lot of food that's shipped in from a lot of places. You can get, you know, you can get grapes from South America and strawberries and that kind of thing. So we had one guy who was predicting that peak oil would put a real damper on globalization.
Well, I can definitely see that argument, and of course, peak oil would then factor into any discussion that you would have about whether the U.S. might be headed towards collapse. And I guess that sort of leads to my next question, which is, how much material carries forward from one salon to the next? Do you feel like you're having sort of an ongoing conversation where the subjects that are discussed 1 month maybe have a lot to say about the subjects that come up the following month?
I would say that yes and no. There is some topics that come back over and over, but there's a lot of new ideas each time as well. So it's not entirely one way or the other way. It does tend to be an ongoing conversation to some extent because there are certain people that tend to come back over and over. So there's like a handful of regulars. But then there's a lot of people who will only come to a meeting because they're interested in that particular topic.
Mm-hmm.
So every meeting will have some unique and different people as well. So it's always a combination of the two.
Yeah, well, obviously everybody likes to whip out their hobby horse. And, you know, at any meeting, I'm bound to probably say something similar to what I said before. I would just think that if you're talking about the future of education or the future of globalization 1 month, and then the next month you're talking about how societies choose to fail or succeed, it would seem like there's probably some crossover between those kinds of, more there than, say, between the Fermi paradox and the future of education, right? That would be a harder line to draw, probably.
Actually, I would say that there's more overlap between the Fermi paradox and the collapse discussion.
That may be
kind of hard to see, but at the Fermi paradox discussion, we talked about things like, you know, what happens if a civilization destroys itself in a nuclear war, or what happens if a civilization, once it reaches a certain point, you know, there's a certain probability of getting hit by an asteroid, right? So
so the Fermi paradox. Okay.
So we talked about, well, maybe the answer to the Fermi paradox is that civilizations don't travel through space because before they get to that point, something catastrophic happens.
Collapse.
And at the collapse meeting, we also talked about some of these catastrophic possibilities. And we didn't talk about them at the future of education.
Okay, well, there you go.
Future of education, we talked about things like... Well, the thing that strikes me the most is there was a person, Sarah Kelnhofer, at that meeting who talked about how in America there's a lot of people who don't value education and who aren't enthusiastic about going to school and not enthusiastic about learning, and that it's not considered, quote-unquote, cool. And we also had a guy there named Jim who talked about how the U.S.'s major exports are entertainment and weapons. and it's just like, oh, gee, is there a connection there? You know, like maybe if entertainment is what we value as a society, then maybe you don't want to learn a lot about math and science, say. Maybe that's not cool. So it was much more a sociological type of discussion.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can see that. Okay. So that just goes to prove the point where you would expect to see the lines drawn, they're not drawn, mm-hmm. and where I wasn't looking for them, they were. So Fermi paradox ends up being related to the collapse of society, and education maybe bore more relationship to the discussion about the future of persuasion, where I think some of those...
Right, or economics.
Yeah, okay, where some of those same topics had come up.
Yeah.
Well, and now that we've talked about the collapse of society and how the Fermi paradox could be proof that collapse is inevitable, I think we've established that we don't always take a positive spin on the future here on Fast Forward Radio. But, Michael, any final questions from the chat room?
Man, we've been all over the map in the chat room, but I didn't bring it back in because it was hard for me to establish a context in which it wouldn't be, well, I think we were borderline illegal once or twice, but mostly it was just, you know, rude.
Yeah, just filter out the blue material. That's all we ask.
I have a question. I mean, if someone were interested in establishing their own local future salon, I would think, Wayne, you would be the guy to talk to. Should they contact you through the Boulder Future Salon webpage? How would they go about getting advice from you as to how to start their own local chapter?
They can do that, although they can also contact the ASF at accelerating.org, too.
Okay.
In fact, I believe there are resources on accelerating.org for those who are interested in starting their own future salon. Let's just put that into the context of when you got yours going. Wayne, what's the job description? How much time of a commitment is it for you, and how difficult was it to find people to participate and some of those kinds of things?
Well, it's more of a time commitment than it looks, but it's fun, so... It is always a challenge finding people to come in and talk about interesting topics, and I'm always looking for new people and people with interesting perspectives and people who want to come and talk about a particular topic or who just want to come and listen or participate in the discussions afterwards.
And how did you initially find people to participate in the salon, not just the speakers, but the actual salon attendees, the participants?
Well, I did a number of things. The main thing I did was I piggybacked. We hold the Future Salon at Boulder Bookstore, and I piggybacked on some of the bookstore's events. So, for example, when Seth Lloyd came to talk about quantum computing, right, I went and passed out flyers and said, hey, you know, let's have a Future Salon discussion on quantum computing, right? And I also did things like I put it on the internet, I put it on a website, boulderfuture.org, and I put it on Craigslist, and I put it on meetup.com, and people find us through some of these other, through the internet as well.
So a lot of just kind of organic, it sounds like, word of mouth type?
There's definitely word of mouth as well. People who like it, they'll bring their friends and...
And I know in my case, I found it through accelerating.org. So anyone who's looking for one in their area, you might start there and just see if there already is one, because there are several, a couple dozen, I would say now, probably.
There's a whole bunch now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are quite a few.
It's catching on everywhere, all over the country, and even a few outside the country.
Good stuff. Well, and that sort of leads back to the Global Futures Network. Why that group got put together was kind of a sort of a clearinghouse for people with all kinds of different perspectives in the future, whether they're in salons or degree programs or other, to have an opportunity to interact with each other. Well, Wayne, we thank you very much for being with us this evening, and we hope that we'll be able to have you back on Fast Forward Radio again in the near future.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
All right.
Okay.
I want to let our listeners know that we'll have links to all the books and the topics and everything that we've talked about tonight at The Speculist in the show notes. So check that out.
All information discussed should be findable there, and we'll also have a link back to our closing music, which will be what this evening?
We've got Fundus Inc. is the name of the band, and the song is Bigger Than Us.
Bigger Than Us. All right. Sounds like it could be about the future, actually.
Yeah, I guess it is. Well, it's been fun tonight, Phil.
It has been fun. Thank you very much, Stephen. Thanks to our guest, Wayne Radinsky, and to Michael and all who participated in the chat room. We'll look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com, or if you don't mind typing a few more characters, blog.speculist.com will take you to all the good stuff. On the blog and here on this program, we talk about the future. We talk about emerging possibilities and emerging technologies. We talk about a future that we think is going to be very bright, one that's coming sooner than most of us expect, and one that we think that we're all very much going to want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always, is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, as I mentioned last week, I think I'm still in the late throes of a kind of a lingering spring cold here. So,
man, you're still fighting that, huh? That's
still fighting it. It moved from my
head to
my chest, and you know what? I think it's you know, just because this topic is endlessly fascinating to the listeners, I'll spend that on some. I believe it's a sinus infection that kind of turned into a bronchial thing.
Oh, man. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're getting over it. That's
no
fun.
I've got the cough button ready at any time that I need to, but never mind all that. How are things with you?
All's well. Had a very interesting weekend, and all fired up about tonight's show.
All right. Well, tell us about your interesting weekend. What's going on there?
Well, today I went, this is the first time I've ever done this, which I'm kind of ashamed of, but here's the deal. I went to a Civil War reenactment for the first time today, and I mean, I've lived within...
I have to stop you right there. Now, just to clarify, you're ashamed that you've never done it before.
Exactly. Because I live within just a few miles of it, and all these years, I knew about when they did it and just never bothered to show up, you know, now that I've gone this first time, I probably will go additional times. It's fascinating how these guys pull it together and make it look believable. And it's some really dedicated guys that take it very seriously what they're doing. And
I'm sure they do. Now paint the picture. How many people are we talking about here on both the Confederate and Union sides?
There was a couple hundred reenactors out there. This is the Battle of Pleasant Hill is the name of this battle. Now, unfortunately, they didn't have anything like the cast of characters they would have needed to, completely reenact the battle. The casualties alone at the Battle of Pleasant Hill numbered 8,000.
Wow.
And they had a couple of hundred reenactors, but I tell you, it was fascinating that some of the fighting was up in the woods, and you'd hear it and you wouldn't see it, and then other fighting is right out there in front of you, and I mean the cannons are booming, and there's guys on horseback, doing kind of a it's sort of interesting because they'd charge up with their horse, they'd shoot, and then they as fast as they could they'd get back behind the lines because you have one shot,
right?
There was a few guys out there that had like repeating rifles, and because that was just a brand new thing at the time. But most of them were out there shooting muskets.
Well, the cutting edge technology was the repeating rifle.
That's
well,
right.
I just had as you're describing this scene. You think about these thousands of guys who fought at the Battle of Pleasant Hill, and what if you could go back and take one of them to one side and say, you know, 150 years from now, people will actually get together to reenact this. It will be kind of an educational, social leisure activity for people to get together and pretend like they're fighting this battle that you're actually fighting. I wonder what people from that era would make of this weird future that we live in.
they think that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. Because, and you know, I would imagine that there wasn't a whole lot of reenactment going on while the guys that participated in the Civil War were still alive.
Well, certainly not of the Civil War.
Yeah.
I wonder if back in the day if they reenacted Revolutionary War battles or something like that.
Maybe that, you know, maybe they did. I'd have to look that up, the Daughters of the Revolution or whatever, and see if they were doing stuff like, you know. But, you know, as to me, it was probably, you know, much too serious, you know, to do a whole lot of reenacting probably while those guys were still alive. Right, it was fascinating. I'm glad I got to do it, and I'll probably attend more of these things. But yeah, it was cool. Had a good time with that.
Yeah, I think the seriousness would be the real difference. I think that you could tell that guy that, and he would say, "Wow, the future is going to be this unbelievably frivolous place."
Yeah.
If
I were to go back in time, I would say to my fellow Southerners, you know, guys, you're going to lose.
It ain't going to work.
This isn't going to work. Why don't we call this off and sue for peace and see what you know, because thousands and thousands and thousands are going to die, and but you know, we would not be the country we are today were it not for the wars that we've had to endure. So I guess
that's true. Although that would make a great story. You go back in time, try to persuade him, and they're all like, "Oh, the guy from the future. Should we listen to him?"
No, this man's crazy, obviously.
Yeah, it'd be a good story though.
Yep.
Speaking of things that are crazy, things that are serious, things that are frivolous, we've also got, and I won't say which of these applies, we've also got Michael Darling on the line. Michael, how are you?
I'm good, and actually I would hope that at least most of those apply.
Oh, okay, well, fair enough.
All at the same time.
I've been, sometimes, more often than I would probably prefer. I was listening with great interest to Stephen, your tale of participating in this reenactment of the Battle of Pleasant Hill. Of course, I've got Google right in front of me, you know, also known as the Oracle, and or the Sage.
Yeah.
And I quick looked it up, and yes, it was in 1864, so you could have told that guy you were going to lose. They probably already were leaning that direction. But on that particular day, the South won. Battle of Pleasant Hill went to the Confederacy. So
that was the last major win, I understand, of the Confederacy. From then on, it was downhill for the Confederacy after the Battle of Pleasant Hill.
Well, 1864, there couldn't have been much good news for the Confederacy after that.
And that's right.
The battle occurred in April, so I don't know if you guys were doing the reenactment specifically as a, you know, tying it close to the date or what.
Yeah, as close to the date as possible and still be on a weekend, I think, is what it amounted to. It was 144 years ago, I think, Friday.
And I can't help but ask if your propensity to participate in the future would be in any way affected or shaded by the fact that you're participating in a battle where the South won versus participating in a reenactment where the South got their butt kicked.
Well, I tell you, it was interesting. They this doesn't really answer your question, but I think I want to share this with the audience, that I thought it was done in a classy sort of way. They start this off, you know, by saying, you know, we're going to have a moment of silence for the men who died on this field 144 years ago, and they have the moment of silence. Then, you know, we pledge allegiance to the flag, and then, you know, play the national anthem. And it's all very, it's to emphasize the reconciliation,
right,
of the North and the South, and that, you know, this we're recognizing our heritage here, but, you know, nobody out there among all these Southerners is longing for the South to rise again. You know, maybe there's a few rednecks out there, but I mean, for the most part, you're dealing with the the realization and the understanding that we are a greater nation because of the way it turned out. And
although, correct me if I'm wrong, it is more or less a Southern thing. I mean, nobody up in Ohio is saying, hey, let's get together and find a battlefield and reenact.
Oh, you are incorrect. No,
yeah, okay. Gettysburg is a big deal.
Gettysburg, of course, but...
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, most of the battlefields are in the South.
Yeah.
That's
sort of a marker of who's the losing side. You know?
Right. Yeah, I would guess.
Yeah, the battle, if the battle's in your backyard, that's not a good thing.
But they had that campaign into the North. They fought the Battle of Gettysburg. And see, I would think, getting back to Michael's question, that even if one were a Confederate buff and couldn't stand being in a battle where his side lost, you would think you'd still want to fight Gettysburg because you got Pickett's Charge and there's all these heroic, you know, Confederate things going on within the context of a given battle. So I would think it's not as simple as just who won the battle or who lost the battle. But
yeah, and I believe me, I was not asking the question from any perspective other than, you know, you indicated you hadn't done it before, you have now, you would again. And I was like, so what would you be looking for? For me, if I had the opportunity to participate at Gettysburg, I mean, I could easily imagine becoming so obsessed with the impending participation that it would consume every part of my life, and like years would go by, and I'd still be fighting the Battle of Gettysburg.
Well, some of those reenactors are very much that way. I mean, they may have a day job, but the rest of their life is consumed with reenacting. I guess you could be that way about any hobby, but that's some of those reenactors are very, very serious. You got guys out there with 2-foot beards, you know. They look the part, you know.
Well, Matt in the chat room notes that he lives near Gettysburg, and he says he's never been, and now he's going to pay it a visit. So I think we've done our historical duty here in talking about this today.
Yeah,
we've encouraged a young person to check out the heritage. One final note on that. I was thinking once again as you were talking about the Pledge of Allegiance and singing the Star Spangled Banner and everything. Wouldn't that, to our hypothetical Confederate soldier who actually fought in the real battle, just make the whole thing even all the more surreal, right?
Yeah.
Here we
are
in Louisiana, all these Southern guys reenacting the battle. And by the way, the first thing we're going to do is pledge allegiance to the U.S. and sing the American National Anthem.
Yeah. Well, they maybe think those were terms that were imposed by the settlement.
Well, yeah exactly.
And to some extent, it was exactly that way. I mean, if you were, you had to take an oath. Those in my family who fought for the Confederacy all took an oath, and I've got the papers around here somewhere. Yeah.
Wow.
In order to be a citizen and be able to vote and things like that, again, you have.
Are there battle reenactors going on like in other parts of the world, or is it really just the Civil War that's motivated this level of historical fanaticism, so to speak?
That's a good question.
I don't know. I would imagine.
I mean, I have seen reenactments of sieges of what were essentially Roman architecture in England and the other parts of the UK, and we maybe have all seen the one where the guy is trying to figure out the trebuchet and whether or not you really can take down a reinforced masonry wall with it, which turns out the answer is yes. It's not that hard. But
that was a powerful piece of artillery for the time, wasn't it?
Used well, you could do a lot of damage. Used well with a contingent that was well provisioned, you could do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all kinetic energy. There's no explosion, but you can throw a lot of stuff. I mean, it always strikes me as funny, and I've seen it in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. There's a scene where they catapult a cow, and you know it's comical to see the flying cow, and it's funny to even think about you're being attacked by this cow. But on the other hand, 800-pound cow coming over the wall is going to change the arrangement of things in a very defined space.
I want to throw this one thing in before we leave the topic. I had the opportunity to talk to a guy whose job it was to decommission artillery shells, and he had actually been called in about 10 years ago at the Battle of Pleasant Hill. They found an artillery shell, okay? And what that was is basically a hollow cannonball filled with black powder. And it's still very, very dangerous. And if anything, the black powder just becomes more unstable over time. And it was his job to, you know, he says you start with a very slow drill, and then you have to, you know. He went through the whole process with me, and I said, man, why don't y'all just, just take it out there and put it in something and explode it, you know? But, oh, well.
Drop it in the lake, maybe. I don't
yeah,
know.
Or something. Why stand there, stand over it and drill into it and then get the black powder out? You know, why, I mean, sounds to me like unnecessarily dangerous. But anyway, I guess they're the experts. I won't argue with them.
Well, that's the question you probably ask yourself quite a bit when you become the artillery handling specialist.
Yeah, why did I get it? Mom always said I should have been a doctor or something, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, now we have strayed far from our intended topic this evening.
Yeah, far future.
All very interesting because, yeah, we wanted to talk about the distant future, and here we are, we're stuck in the past. So I'm going to shift gears for us now, and I'm going to say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil, Stephen and Michael talking about the future. If you'd like to join us, you can also talk about the far future. Call us at 347-215-8972. So a good question that came from Michael in the email earlier this evening as we were just sort of trotting out this topic for tonight was, what do we mean by the far future? What exactly is the far future? And I think that there are a number of different approaches to how you might answer that question. I go back to, I think when I was in the maybe sixth grade, seventh grade, somewhere in there, I started reading, it would have been the Dune series of books, and I also started reading the Asimov's Foundation trilogy, and really blew me away because it was the first science fiction that I had read where it had occurred to me that this was actually set not, you know, like Star Trek a couple hundred years in the future, but this was set like thousands of years into the future. And especially Dune, if you read that series, you know, thousands of years pass during the during the course of the story. And I used to read Legion of Superheroes, which of course was set in the 30th century. So that's the distant future. So to me, I guess my first initial inkling of what is the distant future would have been anything more than anything past Star Trek, right?
Yeah,
is the distant future, and
there's an alternative way of looking at it, though.
Well, yeah, that's a kind of a lame, you know, juvenile way of looking at it. But that's my original framing, you know.
Yeah.
Like, well,
yeah.
Well, the distant future would be anything past all of that. And then it occurred to me that I'd actually read The Time Machine before I read either of those other two books, and of course. It doesn't hit you the same way, but in The Time Machine, he goes to the year, like, I'm going to say like 800,000 or something like that. He goes 800,000 years into the future, that's where you have the whole conflict between the, oh, I can't even think of what they're called, the Eloi and the
Morlocks.
Thank you.
Morlocks, that's right.
Yeah, well done, Stephen. All right, he knows his H.G. Wells.
Well, I'm impressed that you remembered Eloi. I would have forgotten that.
Oh, well, there you go. I guess
that's why we're a team.
Yeah, that's why we work so well together. So what's interesting about that future, if we could start with that one, because I think we're all familiar either with the book or with some one of the movie versions of The Time Machine, is for 800,000 years into the future, things haven't really changed all that much. I mean, people, you know, the Morlocks are, you know, they're big and ugly, and the Eloi are little and cute, right? But other than that, the world is still pretty much the same. And in fact, they hadn't even developed much in the way of technology, which was kind of a surprising turn for H.G. Wells to take. What you guys have any thoughts on that particular future, or your own like initial thoughts on what would define the distant future?
Well, my idea on that was that I think H.G. Wells is basically saying that, you know, however far we advanced, it all fell apart by the distant future where the Morlocks and the Eloi showed up. You know, whatever civilization we had created apparently had not lasted.
Okay, so they're kind of post-technological at that.
That's right. And so, you know, exactly.
In a way we never get to understand.
I'm sorry.
There's no hint in the H.G. Wells time machine about how did the Eloi get to be so, you know, casual? Why don't they care? Why do they have any curiosity? Why don't they have books? Why haven't they advanced? And the implication was that, you know, this is the advance by definition. They're in the future, so it is the advance. But there's no exposition for what the heck happened.
Well, I think it was sort of understood. The Eloi were the descendants of the upper crust who no longer worked. And the Morlocks were the descendants of those that were kept down in the dank dungeons, working hard, and so sort of in a way it was the revenge of the proletariat kind of idea.
You got Darwin meets Marx.
Yeah.
And basically the classes have evolved into different species.
Exactly.
So that's
what that was. So. Which is kind of a dark way of looking at the future. But the other thing I wanted to point out was that, and I think that you kind of had pointed to this, Phil, earlier in an email, that you don't have to go distant in years to have a very different future, particularly if you take into account the ideas of the singularity. If we are 20 years or 30 years from the singularity, you talk about a much different world in a very short period of time.
Absolutely true. In fact, one of the criteria that I would use for defining the distant future, because where I was going with the whole time machine thing was that you probably can't put a date on it.
Right.
That probably it makes more sense to say, well, what are the characteristics of the future such that we would say, well, that is a distant future? And one of them would be when the world is no longer recognizable to us.
Right.
So to take an earlier example from human history, you had people living as hunter-gatherers for, I guess, hundreds of thousands, millions of years, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And so there could have been a passage of time of incredible length there, 20, 30,000 years between generations, and essentially very little changes. Then suddenly, over the course of what some say might have been just a few generations, agriculture kicks in, and within a few hundred years, you've suddenly got people living in cities, and the whole civilization process is beginning. And so, people from just a few generations apart would look at people from the hunter-gatherer space would look at that future world and say, "That's completely unrecognizable to me. That world has been completely transformed." So
right.
That would definitely be the distant future to them, right? The world we live in, or even the world that the most primitive civilized agrarian society occupied, would have been the distant future to them. And,
yep.
And to your point, yeah, the world beyond the day that the first greater than human intelligence emerges starts to become a world that we might not recognize.
Which is what makes a singularity scary to a lot of people, and understandably so.
I think it'll be the lack of recognition will be more, what's the right words? It will be, it could happen because of a other than biological intelligence. It could also happen just because the biological intelligence is beginning to incorporate or share with the non-biological devices in such a way that, forget about not understanding the words to all the music, which was always a complaint of my grandparents and parents. You know, you couldn't understand all these songs today. What are these people singing about? And frankly, I hear songs, I think the same thing.
What is up with that?
Yeah.
That's right. But it will be more foreign and more alien on a sort of a meta level, that not just I won't be able to understand my grandchildren's music, I won't be able to understand them.
Yeah. Well, and I would suppose that you'd have the opportunity in a world like that to upgrade, so you could understand them.
One would hope.
Yeah, and that's the temptation. You would want to, in order to be a part of the ongoing world, that, you know, that's why you don't stay, you know, normal people at that point. You upgrade and do what you need to do in order to participate in the conversation of how the world's going to go.
Although to extend Michael's analogy, even if the upgrade option is there, I mean, technically, all our parents had the option of listening to and trying to comprehend our music, right?
Yeah.
and did not avail themselves.
Yeah, most of them
and
did.
And so why not? Why would I opt for the same upgrades and implants as my grandchildren, but my grandmother was just never going to get behind the Grateful Dead?
Well, I think the reason is that your grandmother's world was still alive and kicking. I mean, there was, you know, she still had her quilting bees, and she still had her ladies' clubs and this and that that was still going on.
And there was an AM station still playing her music.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, perhaps that could be the case for us bogeys, you know, 30 years from now, that, you know, there's still a mosh culture. Let me explain what mosh is. Mostly original substrate human. That's Kurzweil's term of what normal people will be called. After
I'm talking
there's
about the mosh pit thing and the kids and the crazy dancing and all
that. That's right.
The two overlap.
Yeah. Well, normal humans may have their own culture still 30 years from now, and so maybe we take refuge in that. But I'm hopeful to be a part of what's going on, you know. So
I can't help but picture the one of my favorite Star Trek episodes of all versions of Star Trek in any media, and that's the one where Moriarty comes back the second time in Next Generation. And in the first one, Data basically defies the holodeck to give him a challenging, or I think Geordi does it for him, but they defy the holodeck to give a challenging Sherlock Holmes episode to Data, and the Moriarty character is actually too dang smart. And he succeeds in exiting, or from the holodeck, controlling the Enterprise, and the only way they rein him in is by explaining to him that, look, you're not really a person. You're a character in the holodeck, and we don't know what to do with you. And he's like, well, that's disappointing to find out.
Yeah.
But figure it out, and what do you propose to do with me in the meantime? And they go, we will store you, your program, and all intact, and we'll research it. Well, in storage, he resurrects himself and takes over the ship and says, you didn't do anything to figure out how to save me. And at the end of the episode, that particular episode, they send Moriarty in his own little self-confined universe, give him his own Star Trek or ship to take over, and his own little universe, which for them is like a little plastic cube that Data gets to keep in his room. And, of course, you know, the obvious implication is that the Moriarty character is never going to know that it's not the real world, that he's just this, you know, program thing interacting with this little programmed universe that they created. And so they look around, and I think it may be Riker, somebody looks up and says, computer, freeze program, just to make sure that they haven't somehow created their own, that Moriarty didn't trap them at a level that they didn't realize wasn't going to be the real world. And, you know, you're left with it. And I'm like, yeah, well, back it up. I can't help but think that in the mosh and non-mosh universe, the non-mosh, they get tired of the flash hanging around, are just going to create our little holodeck for us, and we'll never know the difference.
So we can live free of the weird people that are so far beyond us.
As long as we never know the difference, we'll never know the difference.
Exactly.
So it's really okay. It's if there's bugs in the system, you go, oh man, this isn't really Earth. They've got us, you know, we're in the Matrix. That would be good. Of course, I don't intend to be a mosh. I'm gonna, you know.
You can upgrade,
I feel.
Yeah, my general thinking there is I'm like a 2.0 adopter. You know, I don't want the first implant. Although
okay.
If they offered me a bionic knee right now, I'd take it. But in general, I don't want the first, you know, intellectual or personality implant. Others around me may feel like I should take it. But at 2.0, I feel like I'd be ready to start, you know, dabbling if I could.
Yeah, you never want to be on the bleeding edge when you're talking about brain upgrades. I agree completely.
You know, well, that's been an interesting point of note about us anyway. You know, here we are talking about the far future, and we published this blog and this podcast about accelerating change and emerging technologies. But we're all a little bit fuddy-duddy when it comes to adopting new technology. I mean, Stephen, you were telling me today you just finally got your first iPod over the weekend, right?
I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, I might be the last person to get one because I felt like, well, you know, I don't want to bow to the Apple people like all these other cultists, you know.
You beat me.
Yeah. Oh, you still haven't got one?
I'm iPodless.
Okay, all right.
Now, I run iTunes on my laptop, and I...
His 8-track player works fine, and he's...
tell you, I got to give it a positive review. I bought the iPod Touch, which is basically an iPhone without the phone. And I got to tell you, you know, it is just absolutely a work of art. I mean, it's like it's a product from the future. That's how cool it is. But at any rate,
it can't fly.
No, it can't. But it can play music in a very cool way. So,
just imagine what the MP3 players will be like in the distant future.
They'll be invisible. We'll be implanted in our brains.
I will relate one iPod experience I have, and I think in a way I can't fully comprehend. This is relevant to the conversation about near future and far future. I went on a weekend trip a year ago for the Super Bowl, not just this last one, but a year and a half ago. And I was flying in on Saturday and flying home on Sunday. I was intentionally traveling very, very light. Didn't even bring a cell phone. Brought my laptop, and that was it. And I was staying at a friend's at present unoccupied condo. It was furnished, but they live in another city, and I was staying in their condo. And my friend had FedExed me a key and said, look, I don't know what's in the refrigerator. I don't know what's there. Make yourself at home. But I can tell you there's no phone. We don't have a phone on there. And you might get a Wi-Fi network from one of the neighbors, but, you know, I don't know what's there. Well, I opened my laptop, and I was no more than two or three blocks from a major college campus in this city, and my MacBook must have seen 100 Wi-Fi networks. And so it was just a hunt and peck to find one that I could get on. Well, it hadn't occurred to me before I left to load up the iTunes with a bunch of music, so I at least have music there. But I opened iTunes, and of course, if you're an iTunes user, you'll know this, there's such a thing called shared iTunes playlists. And I looked in my iTunes knowing that there was, you know, less than four songs there, and there's all these shared playlists. There must have been 200 shared playlists that popped up. Well, it was Saturday night, and there was a huge party going on somewhere in the neighborhood where I was, and all these people had their wireless devices that had their iTunes playlist set up to share. By midnight, it was starting to get thinner, and by the next morning, there was like two or three playlists I could see, and I was like, wow, I could just keep this thing open, and if there was a way to, you know, sort of interact and monitor with all that sharing going on at any given time, there's no need for me to load this thing up with music anymore, as long as I don't want to control the music. And there was such a variety of, quote, shared stuff I could choose from, I didn't care.
Yeah, but of course, if everyone takes that attitude, then no one will be motivated to load it up.
And yet everyone will, because everyone will have some level of control. I mean, I look at my iTunes now. This MacBook was less than 4 weeks old at that point. I just hadn't occurred to it. When I open iTunes now, it's bulging at the seams that I should really move all this stuff off of here onto an external thing, because it's just clogging up the machine.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and our lines are open now if you'd like to join us. We're talking about a lot of different topics, but it all relates to the future, and we're sort of touching on the distant future this evening. You can call us at 347-215-8972.
I'd like to, kind of take a vote around the table here. Does the distant future include finding other intelligent species in this galaxy?
Okay.
Of course, this is a whole Fermi paradox thing all over again. So.
Well, biological or not, let's start.
Doesn't have to be. I mean, just intelligence of any kind in this galaxy.
I think because of the way humans define intelligence, there will come a time where we know more about the galaxy than we currently do, and we will interpret that as signs of intelligence, whether or not we actually can encounter the intelligence itself.
Okay. Okay.
So I've dodged the question, but made it sound very, carefully dodged.
All right, Phil, can you dodge the question too?
And I will dodge it differently. I doubt that we will encounter another viable, ongoing, intelligent species. I think it's possible that we will find evidence of one that wiped itself out, or of one that hit the singularity and then disappeared, either transcended to another universe or went into inner space, or they're not to be found anymore. I think those scenarios are possible. I think that there is a contemporary, you know, that the Klingons are out there or something like that, I think is not terribly likely.
Yeah.
To that type of answer, to that specific a measure of there's other intelligent beings and we either find them or we won't or whatever, I would say this. We have no useful or intelligent way to make that prediction, Fermi paradox or not, because we don't really know, based on how we decide we know things, we don't really know what the likelihood is of Earth having produced life, let alone any place else. But even if we just say, well, you know, there's enough stars like the sun and there's enough planets like Earth that, you know, the probability is what? Well, we don't know. We don't have all the entering arguments to calculate the probability. If you're
we've got a group of one. You know,
from that we predict the likelihood. Well, we can't
predict. You're exactly right.
We need a repetitive event in order to establish even the tiniest data sample against which, again, from how we define how we know something, from a heuristic success start point, we'd need a separate repetitive event in order to go, okay, now we know. This is roughly what it takes. This is the likelihood. We think there's 200 billion stars in the galaxy. Let's go from there. Well, we don't have that.
Well, and I agree completely, but let me answer my question myself. I agree, you know, again, I agree that we just don't know enough to make any kind of useful predictions about whether there's life in this galaxy, but the Fermi paradox is, to me, pretty convincing. If there were other intelligent life that was, you know, capable of traveling and getting to us, they would have done so. And, you know, so where is everybody? That would tend to speak to the fact that we are probably alone.
They're in Stephenville, Texas, man. We know that.
Yeah, exactly. But, I think we're probably alone. And so if we're able to travel in interstellar space, and that's what the far future holds for us, then I think that's important, the fact that we, you know, are going to be alone. And that gives us a lot of area to explore without, you know, running into some other species that could potentially be a competitor. So.
Now, Harvey in the chat room has asked us whether we think there used to be life on Mars, and if we dig, will we find some cities? So rather than opening up that whole can of worms again, I've gone ahead and sent him a link about my dog and astounding truth about Mars. I didn't think the
connections with Phil are just, I mean, it will blow your mind.
Let me rephrase my answer. Yes. There is life out there. We have found it. I've got it living in my house.
So. Fortunately, it's a dog. That's nice.
He appears to be a dog. Yeah.
I'll throw out a near future, far future anecdote that I got me thinking about both contemporary things and the near future, far future in a more useful way, I think. I was at a lunch with some people I knew, but a larger group of folks, most of whom I didn't know, one of whom was trying to be very provocative and turned out to be somewhat annoying. But the provocative part, the provocateur in him, got him saying, you know, think 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 years in the future. What's on tap for America and what's on tap for the world? And a very elderly gentleman that I hadn't met prior to this lunch sitting next to me said, well, it depends on, you know, how many thousands of years you want to talk about. But at some point in the future, the landmass that is, you know, currently down around San Diego is going to be up in the Aleutians. And, you know, that's going to change America. And so if you mean that kind of change. And now it struck me as odd that he would just kind of throw that out, like, you know, plate tectonics was always something in the back of his mind. Well, it turns out it was. He was he had built pipelines in his day job for 50 or 60 years, and in fact built the first pipeline over the Andes in South America and was a major part of building the Alaskan pipeline. And in parts of the Andes that were relatively unstable, they had engineering design issues where they had sections of pipe moving lateral to each other because the pipeline was going east-west and the landmass was going north-south, roughly 6 inches a quarter. And the goal is to build a pipeline without having to shut down the flow and accommodate that kind of geologic movement, which I thought was just flat out wicked ass cool. And I got
We need a telescoping pipeline.
Yeah, well, you need. Well, you can go and look how they did it. It's really rather amazing and very impressive. But I got to talking to him after lunch and kind of zeroed in on this. You know, what else did that lead you to think about in accomplishing that challenge? And he goes, eventually, we got to a point with the company where we realized we owned a lot of real estate, but it was, you know, relatively narrow in very long strips. And what could we do with that as a real estate investment besides the pipelines that we already had? And at some point, partly for internal corporate uses and partly for other reasons, they started putting fiber optic through their pipes and through their right-of-way, whether or not it was inside the pipe or next to it or whatever. And I was like, oh, that was sort of forward-thinking.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go into some remote area with a crew to build the pipeline. You might as well run the fiber at the same time and then figure out what to do with it later. And so they definitely overbuilt the network. But I was like, okay, that was a sort of a stunning accomplishment of thinking far future and having a perspective bigger than, you know, I live in the 20th century and this is my life. And at the same time, bringing that back into the office and going, yeah, but we got to be able to do something better with, we can be smarter with the real estate that we have, which happens to be long and thin strips going long distances.
Well, you know, I think that's an important point. Those who do well are those who can, you know, lead their shots. You know what I'm saying? Those who see where things are going and plan for it, and they look like fools at the time, don't they? but then they look like geniuses later. You know, the important thing is looking like a genius later, rather.
Well, and I'm sure there's
being willing to look like a fool in the short term, but being the genius later.
I'm sure there's plenty of people
who end up looking like geniuses later, which is history writes them off as fools.
Or doesn't even know about them.
Exactly, yeah.
They led their shots in such a way that nobody cared, and it never mattered to anyone ever.
Yeah.
So really, just take a crazy risk on the future, because people will only remember if you were right.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, they could remember if you're colossally wrong.
Well,
maybe everybody in your family will remember. You know, things were going pretty well until Phil invested in whatever. Yeah.
Based on Mars, yeah.
That's right.
But that's interesting. I like the contrast between, you know, let's think ahead a generation or less in terms of let's lay out the fiber optics versus the future where San Diego's up there in the Aleutians. That's the far future from a human civilization standpoint, because I mean, what's the time scale on that? Did he say? Is that 50,000 years from now?
I think he said 30 to 50,000 years, but I actually think it's a little bit longer than that.
Okay.
Now, in geologic terms, you know, it's essentially it's now. It's in our era, but I don't know. And frankly, that's the kind of thing where it seems like you should be able to go look it up and say, hey, where's that part of the North American plate going to be in 35,000 years, give or take a couple hundred miles?
Right. You know, it's interesting because it's like, well, will civilization still be around? Will that matter to us? Will we have all been uploaded? And then it's just a matter of putting the servers in a secure place so that plate tectonics doesn't bother us.
Well, I can tell you this. It'll matter a great deal to the Eloi.
Well, sure.
Because they're living in San Diego now. And, you know, as it moves north, they're not going to like it as much.
It'll get chilly.
Or will we have technology sufficient to deal with that problem when it comes up? Because that's not the only one of those kinds of far future problems that we're going to be dealing with. As you
that's
said,
right.
On a geological scale, that's a blip. But eventually we look at, well, one day the sun will burn out.
Well, that's like 10 million years. That one I know. Best estimates now is 10 million years. And I figure, you know, if we put this off until the nine millionth year and really, you know, cram it in all in the last million years to figure it out, okay, then we're boneheads. But that's where, you know, my answer to the question comes, and I said this offline as we were getting going. Long term, I am pessimistic because I think in very important ways it becomes live or die. It becomes a mortality question whether or not we as a species can organize. And whether you call it cooperate or coexist, there's got to be some kind of co-something where we either live together or die together. And I don't see that kind of organization. It manifests in so many ways where it should happen or it could happen, and it just flat out doesn't. And I go, yeah, and we're, you know, we're only six point something billion people on the world. When we double that in, you know, I don't know, 100 years or 200 years, and we're approaching 10, 12, 30, 13 billion people, how is that lack of coexistence or cooperation going to manifest? I don't know. Someone's going to re-engineer the virus, the flu virus from 1918, and that's going to take out a chunk, or someone's going to make HIV airborne, and that's going to take out a chunk. I don't know, but it ain't going to be the friendly Eloy lounging around with the you know, in their cute togas having fun.
The buzzkill you're listening to is Michael Darling, and this is Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio Network. If you'd like to join and cheer Michael up, you can reach us at 347-215-8972. Well, that is one take, but you know, my response to that one, Michael, is, well, we've made it this far, haven't we? I mean,
absolutely.
We got through the 20th century. We got through all those terrible wars, and we seem to have at least the first instance of two superpowers that were armed to the teeth with thermonuclear weapons ready to take each other down. We seem to get through that one.
So
maybe we're lucky.
Just in 20th century Cold War cosmology, let me just suggest this. Oh, wait. The species got through the first time where two countries were armed to the teeth and could have caused an Armageddon. Call me back when multiple parts of the planet have been armed in such a way, and we've got through it 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 times, and we've got through it so often that it's sort of, you know, it's automatic. We know how to get through it now.
Well, this is one of the things that we talked about when we talked with Philip Van Natervelt from Lifeboat Foundation.
Is, yep.
There's this increase in capability to destroy, and our increase in capability to control that or to mitigate that. And yeah, the great danger is that the one overtakes the other, and it doesn't have to do it for long for things to look pretty bleak.
Well, and I don't know if it was
which argues in favor of colonizing Mars or something. You know, not having all our eggs in this one basket.
Well, you want to have a backup plan. You know, it's like if San Diego is going to move to the Aleutians, well, that's a good reason to, you know, maybe have a place in Kansas City or something like that, which I think will probably still pretty much be there in 50,000 years.
I don't know if it was in response to that particular Lifeboat Foundation conversation, but I know that somewhere in that time frame, I posted a note there in one of the comments about Steven Pinker's talk. It was a TED talk where he talked about how when you really measure the level of violence, and he actually sort of normalizes over generations and periods of time for human existence in a fairly useful way, we're actually less violent now than we were before. And we're more aware of it, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago or more to the point, 1,000 years ago, nobody in North America knew what the heck was going on in Darfur. But now, it's on the news and it's on the internet, and we're more aware of it, and so we tend to focus on it. It scares us more because fear is still an important thing for us, but we're actually less violent. And
you know, I've got a way to bring in the whole civil
violence.
I got a whole way of bringing the whole Civil War conversation back into this. 620,000 Americans died in the Civil War. That's a lot of folks, you know. In one day at Antietam, 23,000 people died. Now, you can compare that. It seems like every major conflict that we get into as a country, fewer people die, and which is a good thing. You know, it's cold. It comes a cold comfort to the families who do lose a loved one, but we can be thankful that it seems to be that. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Weren't you telling me, Stephen, that the battle you saw reenacted today, 8,000 people died in that battle? Something like
that's
that.
Right. And, I mean, this is a battle that, you know, not a whole lot of people have even heard of.
Yeah,
a relatively minor battle. 8,000 people died.
Twice the death toll of the Iraq War, or at least the American death toll of the Iraq War.
Right.
Which, you know, is really pretty shocking when you think about it. Not that makes 4,000 a good number, right? Right.
It's a tragedy for every family that's lost somebody. But it's you know, it just goes to show that, you know, we are finding ways to mitigate violence even within the context of wars, which is good.
When it becomes Pinker, not in the TED talk, but in other places, touches on this, becomes less productive. than it was before, and it becomes more more impactful. Each individual or a small 4,000 death number or versus a 600,000 death number, the impact is such that you actually want to minimize it even more if you can.
Right.
And maybe that's a trend. Maybe there's a Moore's law there for the it's not de-escalation, but the dissolution of that sort of violent approach to organizing the planet and organizing the people on it. And
actually, when Pinker explains it, it does have a kind of a Moore's law sound to it because he talks. It
felt like it.
Yeah, he talks about people in prehistoric times who just simply had a much, much, much greater chance of being killed by a fellow human being than we do today. And statistically, even if you count the 20th century and all the unbelievable violence and deprivations that occurred then, people living in that century were less likely to be killed by a fellow human being than, say, somebody living like 50,000 BC. I mean, it was just, that's how most people died, actually.
Yeah.
And that we have moved away from that is a pretty encouraging thing, actually. So,
yeah,
see,
maybe
about it. We didn't even need a caller to.
That's right. Maybe maybe it's just I own a mortgage company and I just keep reading the bad news over and over and over.
You work your way out of it. So let's say we do all get along, and then we're facing things like the tectonic plates, or we work that one out, and then we're facing the sun's gonna explode. We work that one out. Ultimately, we reach a point where the universe itself can't hold up. And that is actually going to be the topic of a little feature that I like to call
Astounding Science Facts.
Our little whale was singing mournfully about the heat death of the universe, guys, and that's our topic this evening on Astounding Science Facts.
You talk about far future. I mean, you can't get any further future than that.
I thought I would take this story all the way to the end, and this is where the universe is going to take us. Now, even if we work out the plate tectonics, even if we work out the sun exploding, we've got this one looking us square in the eye. And look this up on Wikipedia, and they give us some pretty good time frames and some phases in which the heat death of the universe will occur. I think we're all familiar with the idea. Basically, this is the maximization of entropy of the universe. This is the universe itself running down, okay? And they break it down like this. They say that there will be a degenerate age, and that will be from 10 to the 14th to 10 to the 40th years from now. Now, 10 to the 14th, I'm thinking that one is still describable in billions. Michael, you're a math guy. What is that? That's like 100 billion, is that right? Or 100 trillion, something like that?
I don't know. It's a big number.
It's a big number. And by the time you get to 10 to 40, we're past numbers that I think, were, you know, they're squintillion, right? I mean, at that point, they're big numbers from now. That degenerate age is when the universe will stop making new galaxies. It will stop making new stars. Planets are going to fall into stars, or they're going to be flung out from the orbits of stars. Most of the protons, or like half the protons of the universe, are going to decay. And that's going to lead to the black hole age, which will be 10 to the 40th to 10 to 100th power years from now. So a 10 followed by 100 zeros. That's the distant future. And that's when pretty much all that's left in the universe is black holes, okay?
Right.
And right around 10 to the 100th power, the black holes themselves pretty much will disintegrate, and we're going to hit what they call the dark age. We'll be somewhere in the 10 to the 100th to 10 to the 150th years from now, and ultimately the photon age, when there's nothing left but diffuse photons in the universe, somewhere beyond 10 to... basically a 10 with 150 zeros years from now. So that is the distant future, and that is the fate that's looking us square in the face, even if we...
You talked me back into it.
Yeah, I'm pretty pessimistic now. I mean, and you know, there's not much escaping it if you can't escape this universe. There's no real good ways to get around it. I mean, I suppose we could all enter into some sort of virtual reality, but even the maybe hundreds of millions of years can pass within a virtual reality, and while in this universe maybe a couple of seconds goes by. So we can there are ways to expand time, but ultimately, you know, even when you're you know, spending 100,000 years for every second in this universe, time's still ticking, isn't it? So ultimately, you know, there is a period at the end of this sentence.
But
that's this universe.
That's not how it's going to happen, because here's what will happen: we'll get the CERN large collider online later this year, and sometime next year or the year after, we'll start working on the next generation, even bigger collider, and the two operating together will create a new universe for us, and we can tend it for 10 to the 15th years, and then when we haven't figured out the Sun deal, that's when we'll move into our alternate universe that we ourselves, you know, brought about, and it'll be a much younger universe. So we'll have the benefit of hindsight, because we'll be earlier in the universe, but we'll be, you know, more advanced in our technology and humanity.
So this one wears out, we just build a new one and figure out some way of getting into it.
That's the plan.
That's not a bad plan. I think that's an elegant solution. Another one is that we.
I like this plan. I'm glad to be a part of it.
Yeah, I'm.
See, but I think the universe is indifferent to your happiness. So be happy, be mad. I don't think it cares.
It's a good plan. Remind me what movie that line came from, Stan.
Ghostbusters.
Again, from Ghostbusters.
Yeah, that's...
You are a wealth of Ghostbuster lines, my friend. What I was going to say was, that's an elegant plan. Let me throw another one at you. What if we go and hack the source code of the universe and write entropy out?
Or just backup time.
I think that's a brute force approach.
There's
entropy does so many good things.
Yeah, but in the long run, it's going to get us with the heat death of the universe.
Okay, so you can't take it out. You have to code it so it actually has a. You know, a nice, neat telemetric end. It has a, it's confined.
Another way around that. There's a story. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's by Isaac Asimov, and it's about a computer that's given this exact question: how can the entropy of the universe be reversed? And hundreds of thousands, millions of years go by. Mm-hmm. Humanity finally dies off. This computer gets more and more powerful. It becomes sort of the universe. I think its name at the end is like the Universal AC, and it's this thing that spans galaxies, this huge computer. And we're all gone, and it's left with nothing but that question to ponder. And
how do we get past the universe? Yeah, or how the end of the universe? How do we survive that?
Yeah, how can entropy be reversed? And finally, after. You know, countless ages have passed, a solution occurs to it. And I remember the last line of the story is so great. This is spoiler alert for anybody who's intending to read this story, by the way. But and the Universal AC said, "Let there be light."
It was one of the best endings of any science fiction story I've ever read.
I still get a chill when I say that.
I mean, it blew my mind when I was about 12 and read that story. I mean, that was just, I mean... uber cool.
And what's interesting about that is you hear a real echo of that in the ideas of Tipler, who talks about us essentially achieving a state of subjective, eternal time before the universe blinks out. So even though objectively the universe is going to go into this heat death, he talks about finding a trick way around that, whereby we will subjectively experience eternity, so it won't matter that the universe goes out. And it seems like that was kind of the trick workaround, maybe that the Universal AC was using there at the end of its story.
I'm trying to remember the name of that story, but I will put it in the show notes.
Yeah, anyone in the chat room who might know that.
Yeah, but I'll definitely figure out what the name of the story is later and put it in the show notes if we don't figure it out before the end of the show.
Well, I think that's probably taken us right up to where we need to talk about the show notes and what music have we got going on this week.
Okay, well, this week we've got Justin Hopkins and the Guilt. That's the name of the band, and the song is Here Goes Nothing. Of course, as always, you can get a link to the hi-fi version of the song from the show notes, as well as links to all the topics we talk about. You just have to go to the Speculist and catch the show notes. So,
now, did you know we were going to be talking about the heat death of the universe at the end of the show when you picked a song called Here Goes Nothing?
Man, it's just, exactly. There you go. That's the brilliance that is our show planning.
Outstanding stuff. All right. Well, thank you for setting us up with that music. Michael, thank you for your contributions. Great talking with both you guys.
This was fun.
And thanks to our friends in the chat room, to everyone who was listening in. We look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
All right, Jack. 'Cause there's a riot on the earth. Thank you. Yeah.